This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Simon Rowell, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, wow, what a career. Simon has worked on outback oil rigs, managed nightclubs, been a tour guide, and run marketing campaigns. He is the author of Wildcard and The Long Game and The Echo of Others, which was longlisted for the Ned Kelly Awards for Best Fiction Crime in 2018, which is a huge accolade, you know. His latest novel, The Good Dog, is a detective Zoe Mayer story. It's the toughest assignment that Zoe has had, and it's a murderous conspiracy of greed, deceit, and violence. She knows that her and her dog, Harry, may be her only chance to crack the case. Now, that's so unique, isn't it? I mean, there is a German police show, isn't there, where there's an Alsatian?
Inspector Rex, I think it was called.
Yes, yes.
20 years ago, it might still be going, but yeah.
Do you know of any other?
I don't. No, I don't.
Neither do I. Okay, well, so tell me where the idea came from.
The idea came from an article I read in The Age years ago about a police officer who had PTSD, and he was trying to get a service dog for work, and he was refused. And it sort of just sort of spurred me to start thinking about that. Zoe, who's my main character, has got PTSD. She has a certain reaction to drones and helicopters, which caused her to kind of black out. And Harry's there to really warn her when that is going to happen. Mm. So that's his primary sort of purpose. His secondary sort of purpose for her, apart from being a loving dog, is that he reacts in a way to people that lends Zoe some skill in telling people whether they're telling the truth or they're lying or they're being deceptive. So the way he reacts to people, if they're, say, crying, and the way Harry reacts will tell Zoe whether they're actually genuine or not. So inadvertently, he becomes a sort of a tool that she can use to help in her job as well in terms of directly with suspects.
Mm. Dogs, I don't know whether my two could have, because George was a 2 kilo Maltese and John Brown was a 4 kilo Maltese cross poodle. So I don't think they had – well, the poodle was a bit smarter than the Maltese, but I don't think they had the intelligence, say, of other dogs. But dogs are intuitive, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. This Harry character was based on two dogs we had years ago, Jackson and Daisy. Daisy was incredibly smart, and Jackson was incredibly loyal. So between the two of those, I sort of merged them together to create Harry, and that's how he came to be. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like it a lot. So let's talk about how you came to writing, because, firstly, I want to start nightclubs, oil rigs. Wow. Okay. So where did you grow up, and how is it? What has been your journey, your long journey to writing?
Okay. My long journey. When I was about 12 or 13, I decided I want to be a writer.
Oh, wow.
Didn't write anything, just thought that sounded nice and sort of cool, and I could drink coffee and
what sit were you in a room. Reading?
Oh, I was reading all sorts of things back then. I was reading a lot of sort of murder mystery. I've always read really widely. I read history, read biography, read everything really. But it kind of became one of those things where you want it so much that you don't actually put your foot in the water in case you're going to drown.
Yeah,
in something you actually want to do. So I sort of put it to one side a bit. And I also knew that I needed to have some life experience, and I had a fair bit of that before I was 25. I had all sorts of different, varying, weird jobs all over the place. And that sort of helped build a sort of a library of memory that I could then draw upon later on.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because not many people I've spoken to, they've at the age of, say, 12 or those kind of primary years, they've loved reading, but they haven't thought of being as writing as being a career. You know, I think because it doesn't have a career pathway like, say, a policeman or a doctor or a nurse have, those things aren't in your mind, are they, when you're thinking about what you're going to be when you grow up?
And it's like and how, you know, even the idea of like a doing a course in creative writing, I'm not even sure I was aware of one back then.
Yeah.
So I sort of just I parked it and went off and had a bit of a life. I worked, as I said, all sorts of jobs till I was 25. Then I sort of went back to university for 4 years and did a couple of degrees and then sort of embarked on a sort of a corporate type career. Went to Melbourne, had a business there for quite a number of years.
Doing what?
And when I was doing marketing and branding.
Yep.
Work, a lot of corporate work with big corporates and internationally as well. So that was...
That's storytelling.
Yeah, that is storytelling. It's, it was good. And then we had a... in our family, my stepbrother got cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And he's sort of about 36, and he sort of battled it for years and 3 years, and passed away just before his 40th. And through that period, I started to sort of reflect on things that I'd wanted to do but hadn't done. Mm. One was writing. One was moving to the country. So we bought a property up in the country and moved up there, and also I started writing. So I wrote The Echo of Others back in about 2017. It was published 2017. It was probably 2016, 17.
Well, what made you, like, I want to start writing, and you jumped into that really quickly, but talk to me about the genre and how you thought that that's what you were going to be, or were you not aware of genres, you just had this story to tell? How did the first story come out and how did you categorise it?
I think the genre picked itself in a way for me.
Yeah.
I was sitting in a cafe in Kyneton in Victoria, towards Bendigo, and I had an idea just sort of came to me out of the air, and I grabbed a napkin, grabbed a pen and just started jotting this mad sort of plot down. Mm-hmm. And basically 90% of the plot was there on the napkin in about 10 minutes, which was kind of a strange experience. And it's happened since as well, but it's a strange experience for the first time it happens. Obviously it changed as I was writing it, but in terms of the genre, I hadn't thought about genre. You know, I love sort of, literary fiction, you know, your Tim Wintons, your Richard Flanagan type novelists, but the kind of story that was in me was more a commercial fiction sort of story, action sort of based thriller mystery type book, and that's what I was sort of drawn to write. That was what was on the page. So that it's hard to say how it chose me or I chose it. I think probably what I said first is right. It chose me. You know, it's a bit like, hair colour or your eyes, mm-hmm. or, you know, you can play with them a bit, but your hair colour is your hair colour. Mm. So I just dug in after that. I wrote the first book over about a year. I edited it, you know, there was probably 16 drafts of that book. I hired an editor to edit it, and I self-published. I didn't put it out to anybody because I was really...
Why?
Nervous. I was nervous about being being rejected, and I thought going on the slush pile of five publishers and then not hearing anything might kill me. Yeah. And I also wanted to get it out quickly because I knew that, you know, a book, as a publisher, there's a whole process. It gets scheduled. It might be a year down the track, and I wanted to get it out there. I was really excited about the book, so I self-published it, which meant learning how to do cover design, having to do marketing, how to do everything really. And that was a good experience, and it did well. It's still selling probably, I'm probably still selling, 80 copies a month. It's just sitting there, just being bought. But it did pretty well. I sold probably about 5,000 copies of that book.
Oh, yeah, that's not bad.
A lot in America, actually, for some reason, majority in America. And that sort of gave me the confidence, and it got well reviewed too, and that gave me the confidence to then push forward. write the manuscript for The Long Game, which is the first part of this sort of Zoe Meyer series, and Text Publishing picked it up.
And how did that happen? How did Text Publishing pick it up?
Somebody picked it up off the slush pile. I had a read.
So you sent it. You sent.
I sent it in.
And why is it in? Or did you send it to many people?
I sent it to four or five different publishers, mm-hmm. And they were the first to act on it.
Yeah.
And by the time a second publisher had come along, I was already signed.
Oh wow!
And I was very happy to sign with them. They've looked after me very well in terms of.
Yeah.
Assisting me with, especially with the editing of the books. I've had a lot of assistance there, which has been great, and a lot of, it really helps the learning journey as well as you're going forward. And then so after that, it's been two more books with them, and they've talked to me about a fourth in the series now too. So
yeah,
it's all happening. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So now do you you call yourself a writer? Is that what you call yourself?
I call myself an author, yeah. I mean, yesterday I was busy building fences here on the farm, but I do. That's what I am now. It's a bit of a journey, but it's been good. But no, I'm very happy with it. I mean, there's it's nice to get really positive reviews. A lot of people have, especially after the first book, they were writing to me saying, I love these characters. I love Zoe. I want to go and have a drink with Zoe after work. It was that sort of thing. So I knew I'd nail the sort of the female protagonist character pretty much.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about that. Why was your main character female?
Okay, so initially I did this in my original book, The Echo of Others, as well. I did it because it allowed me the freedom to write without worrying about people thinking that I'm writing about myself.
Doesn't work, because you always know that it's about yourself.
Yeah, it is, but it allows me a little bit of grace there. So that's been good, and really, I haven't really written any of the characters as particularly necessarily male or female. I've written them just as people, and that's been probably the reason that it's been successful. I've just written individuals. And people are connected with those individuals. Obviously the dog is not a sort of a talking dog or anything silly like that, but I mean the people, through his sort of non-verbal dogness, people really connect well with Harry too. They love Harry.
Yeah.
The big question I always get at sort of festivals and online is, is Harry going to be okay? And I say, yeah, Harry's, everyone else might not be okay, but Harry will be fine. He'll get in some hairy situations, but he'll come through. Don't worry about that.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I want to go back and talk about some of your other jobs. So Outback Oil Rig, talk to me about how you got there.
Well, when I was 15, I had a girlfriend, and this girlfriend's father worked for an oil company.
Yeah, wow.
And he took one look at me and said, I think you'd be better off about 3,000 miles away. So off he sent me. He got me this job working in the Cooper Basin, and I was up in the middle of nowhere.
So you were 15, really?
Yeah, I was 15.
Wow.
When they
Is that legal?
No, it's not. Oh, it's legal to get a job, but it's not legal to work in the oil fields, no. So when they found out I was 15, they had a bit of a conniption up there, but that was fine. that was actually good. I stayed up there for quite a while.
What were you doing?
I was working on oil rigs up there.
Yeah, but doing what on the rig?
Drilling. Yeah, drilling oil.
At 15.
Yeah, it was insane. It was quite nutty. Then I took a job. I got offered a job with a company that was building the water pipeline, which is going to supply the new town of Roxby Downs, which then was just a lot of steel huts in the middle of nowhere. And I took a job there, and I worked on that job for it was 3 months, 3 month job. It was 24. It was 7 days a week. It was 12 hours a day plus, probably up to 15 hours a day, every day in 55 degree heat and sun. It was just, and people were going insane. But that was interesting as well. And then I sort of went back. I got out of that and went to hotels for a little while.
Hang on, what happened to the girlfriend?
Oh, the girlfriend went eventually, I think.
Yes,
well, when you're 15. I think she was gone by 16, but
also because you weren't there.
That was played a part. I remember calling her from Telecom back then, had left the phone booth out in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and it had been supplying a drilling camp, and the drilling camp had got picked up and moved off, and I had to go and find this telephone between the sand dunes one day, and I was calling her from this phone at sort of dusk, and there was some dingo walking across a sand hill. It was poetic in a way, but yeah, it was a good couple of years, and I went and ended up. I worked in hospitality for a few years. Then I worked in north of Alice Springs in tourism, doing a tour guides out of Alice Springs for a little while.
Oh, wow.
So I've done quite a bit. Then I thought, I really need to get a normal job. So I went back to uni, did a couple of business courses, and then sort of embarked on a new life, a new different life. So it's been interesting.
That would have been a difficult transition. I always think, because we all go to university from school to university, and that transition isn't, so huge, right, because you're in a learning environment. But when you've had jobs like that and have been working for such a long time, was that different? Was that a cultural shock for you to go back into full-time study?
It wasn't. I mean, there were quite a few sort of mature-age students there. I mean, mature-age were 25, and there were people around that sort of age, so we just sort of found each other during orientation and sort of just collected together and sort of worked together, because there were things there that we hadn't touched for a while, like statistics. So we sort of lent on each other a bit, and that was a good experience. There was probably five of us in total that worked together. So no, it worked out pretty well, and I was working full time whilst I was studying as well. So I was quite busy. I was working nights, weekends and everything. So I was doing, 40-hour work weeks as well as full-time study. So it was a big couple of years. And then
it was back in the day when people had stamina.
Stamina, and we didn't have Facebook. So, we had more time.
More social media. Okay, so while you're at university, did you play around with the idea of writing then?
I did. When I was just before university, I remember I wrote something. I wrote a short story from memory.
Yeah.
And I had a Danish girlfriend then, and she read it, and she went and she sort of rolled her eyes a bit, and I went, ugh. So I put that away. I thought I'll put that away for 20 years and see. It wasn't great. Yeah. She's not around anymore either, obviously. I didn't really. I think it was with my stepbrother Paul that sort of. Brought it back into focus, and I sort of I trained myself in terms of writing, in terms of how to go about. I read a lot of books. There's a book called The Story Grid, which is a interesting book on structure, and they've got a podcast as well. And I sort of was listening to that and reading that book in conjunction. That was very useful in terms of getting the structure of the books right. And I used that structure to write The Echo of Others originally, so that sort of helped me. But I'm a curious person, so I tend to sort of look deeply into things when they catch my eye. So I'll really work hard on it. So
and learn. Okay, so when you did start writing, were you still working full time?
Yeah.
So what did a writing day look like?
I was working for myself then, so it was a case of being able to work around work. So I was writing more when the urge sort of hit me. So I'd be writing at night and in the mornings, and it might take, you know, an hour off at lunchtime and write then. So I was probably, you know, going through probably 2,000 words a day, maybe, writing. But that book went through so many iterations. I wrote it. I probably wrote, you know, 300,000 words to write a 90,000 word book. So there's a lot of learning in doing that as well. It's like an apprenticeship in a way.
Well, it's practice. We always talk about that on this podcast. It's practice.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And practice makes as close to perfect as you can get, really. So yeah, it's just a case of continuing to learn and be curious and push and try and make the next book better.
Yeah.
And that's what I always try and do.
When you're writing, are you writing full time now, or are you still working?
We've got 50 acres here, so I'm busy with when we've got a rescued animal sanctuary. So we've got cows and sheep and chickens and a couple of rescued dogs and all sorts of things. So we've got we've got busy things to do around here and keep things going, vaccinations and so forth. But you know, my main focus is writing. Yeah.
So what does a writing day look like now?
Usually it's a case of trying to do work in the morning. So I'll get up and I'll start at 9 o'clock and start like a regular job and push and push and push until I'm out, really.
Yeah.
Out of ideas or out of energy. So it takes.
So you don't give yourself a word count or a no.
I don't tend to do that. I have done in the past, but I tend to just. When I've done it in the past, I've tended to have to throw away a fair bit of writing because I'm just sort of pushing for the words rather than word count rather than the words.
Oh, that makes sense.
So I tend to you know, there'll be some days where I'll write 5,000 words, other days it'll be 500, and I'll say it's not there. But I tend to structure my novels out. I plot them extensively first.
Oh, you do.
So, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I sit down and I'll come up with a basic one pager, with the plot, and then I'll really interrogate that for maybe, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, and just build it out, build the characters out, give them all the attributes, build character maps for everybody in the book, and really just plan to the nth degree. And once I'm sort of happy with that, then I'll start planning out the chapters. And once I've done all that and I've got my character list up on the wall there, I'll start writing.
Okay.
And that tends to mean I don't have to throw away big chunks of work.
Yeah. And do you write in linear? Like, are you writing from beginning to end? Yeah.
I do. Things move around though, but yeah. So from that first one pager, I'll probably end up with, 90% of that will end up in the book. 10% of it will change. There's always some major addition that happens, usually towards the end, to bring things together. But I tend to, you know, people who can write on the fly,
and a lot of people do. Me. Yeah,
they do. I was talking. I was on a panel with Tony Jordan last year, and she said, you know, she sits down and writes, and I'm thinking, well, that's just magic.
Yeah,
I could never do it. I'd sit there and just stare at the page. But she can do it, so it's good for her. It's really good. Yeah. But I think if I was doing it, I'd be writing. I'd be doing a lot of editing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And everyone has a different way of getting to the end of the story. It's really interesting.
Absolutely.
And I've spoken to so many people and so many different ways of storytelling. It's quite interesting. I remember when I first interviewed Tim Winton. And I love his work. And for some reason, I don't know why, because I'd been in the industry a long time by then, but I still thought that he just writes beautiful sentences, like they just come out and, you know, he writes them and they're just gorgeous. But when we spoke, he said he labours over each sentence and writes and rewrites and rewrites. Now, not that that changes anything for me, but it was a surprise to me.
It's good to hear as another author. It's good to hear that sort of feedback, I suppose. Because yes, it's a bit like Tim Winton's one. Colin McCann from New York is always Irish, but he's in New York. He's another one. He writes those beautiful sentences. They're absolutely poetic, but they take work. So that's part of it. But I mean those, with Tim, there's certain sentences that he's written in books that I just almost. I'm almost write down and put on the wall. I mean, they're just so lovely.
Yeah, they're so gorgeous.
And that's a big reason for his massive success.
Yeah. I can't remember which book it was. My favourite is The Riders, for sure. And I've interviewed him a few times since, but I remember with one of his books, it's my friend here in San Francisco, actually. I took a photo of a sentence and I said, I sent it to him. I said, this is for me. It's just perfect. And then I kept reading and then there was another sentence. And in the end, I thought, if I'm not careful, I'm going to break copyright.
Yeah.
By taking all these photos and sending them, which wasn't the intent. The intent was to share one good sentence, but there was many. There was absolutely many. Hey, the Ned Kelly, best first crime in 2018. How'd you feel about that? That's a huge accolade.
That was fairly amazing. There were two self-published, because I've got a number of categories.
Yes.
There were two self-published books that year, I think, that sort of got picked up, which was really amazing. So it was a good feeling. It helped with my confidence a lot in terms of, the feedback from readers had been really good, but it felt great, actually.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So that was that was good.
Well,
really
fantastic.
Good.
That's good for you. All right, we're out of time now. The book is called The Good Dog. Simon, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Cheryl. Thank you very much.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.